Well, I hope you took advantage of the opportunity to walk through our new facility today. The comments that I've heard, it's a lot bigger than it looks from the outside. And I had a couple of people ask me a question that I want to answer. There will not be a trap door behind the pulpit. I'm pretty sure. And if there is, I want to know who's holding the button. If there has been an announcement about it, a latest update, then I missed it. But our latest quarterly contribution for the building is now at $178,000. Is that right? 187,000. That's great. You know, we quite often talk about not using the things that God's given us. Could you turn me down just a little bit? But we don't give credit where credit is due too often. We don't pat on the back when there is one due often enough. And that leads me to encouraging you to stay here following our dismissal tonight, because there will be a report on an orphanage in Cambodia. And if you don't know the story of Hannah's Hope, I want you to hear the story of Hannah's Hope. They probably won't, the Welburns probably won't tell you all that they probably should tell you about how this all got started, but it fits right in with this matter of Christians using what the Lord has given us in a really beneficial way, because this orphanage was begun by a family here, and it has really grown, and there's really a lot of good things that are happening. And so I want to encourage you to remain after our dismissal and hear a relatively brief report on Hannah's Hope. So I hope that you'll do that. I want you to, how many of you brought your Bibles? Hold them up. Let me see them. You know, I'm still trying to figure out if I think that the iPads and the iPhones, that they count for Bibles. I guess they do. I want you to turn to a couple of passages. The first one I want you to turn to, and this is just kind of a little bit of an aside, but it's leading me up to where I want to go. And the first one would be in Jeremiah chapter 29. Jeremiah chapter 29. And I'll wait for you to turn there, because I've got to get there myself. Jeremiah chapter 29. And this is a verse that has found quite a following in the last 4 or 5 years. I see it everywhere. It's become a favorite verse for people to quote. It's in Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 11. And it's the Lord saying, "For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." And that's a really, I like that verse myself, but there's something I want to add to that, because we quote that verse, and it's become such a popular verse that is quoted as if that's all there is to say about the matter. I want you to hold your finger there, and I want you to turn to Amos chapter 9, verse 4. Amos chapter 9 is page 770 in your Bible if you're looking. Amos chapter 9. The Jeremiah passage is written after a number of years in captivity, after God has vented his anger on his people and punish them by sending them into exile. And so he comes with a message of hope in Jeremiah. And he says, I know the plans that I have for you, for your future, and their plans for the good. But it wasn't that long before then, in Amos chapter 9, verse 4, and he's talking to Israel. And he talks about, in fact, Chris this morning read several of those verses. And he says that the Lord says he's standing by the altar and he wants to strike the pillars of it so that the thresholds shake. And then he will go and he'll start talking about his people. In verse 2, though they dig down to the depths of the grave, there my hand will take them. Though they climb up to the heavens, from there I'll bring them down. Though they hide themselves on the top of Mount Carmel, there I will hunt them and seize them. Though they hide from me in the bottom of the sea. He says, you can run anywhere you want to go in the world. It doesn't matter. But I'm going to find you wherever you are, and I'm going to punish you. Look at the next verse. Verse 4. Though they are driven into exile by their enemies, there will I command the sword to slay them. I will fix my eyes upon them for evil and not for good. And the reason that I wanted to contrast those two verses is because people read that first verse and as if that's everything there is to say about God. And they say, you know, God is only going to do you good. God will never do you harm. God will never do anything to hurt you. And they use that passage as one of the proof texts for that. Well, that's a good passage and it teaches what it teaches, but that's not everything there is to say about God. And that brings me to my point that one of the major points that I try to make consistently is the best thing that you can ever do for yourself as a Christian is study everything that you can about God and come to know God as completely as is humanly possible. Because that's going to give your life a consistency that you can't have otherwise. If you build your life around what people are saying about God, and particularly what people, let's just say Christian people today, are saying things like, God will never hurt you, and they quote this verse, and God will only do good for you. Well, when difficulty comes into your life, where's God? And so we need to see God is not a single-faceted God. God is multifaceted. And we need to know everything we can possibly know about God. There are not only times when God will hurt you, there are times when God will kill you. He's done it before, has he not? He's done it to lots and lots and lots of people in the world. And so we need to know that about God. Otherwise, whenever we have been chastised, we'll become discouraged. Because we can't figure out why God would let this happen. And that sets the stage for, I want you to turn now to the prophet Habakkuk. And this is something of a follow-up of our lesson this morning. And if you'll put the chart up for me. And if you'll put the pointer on Habakkuk. All right, you see him right here? Here's Habakkuk. Now, most of you have this chart by now. Those of you in Thursday class, you've got it. Those of you that were in the class when I filled in a couple of Sundays ago for Chris, I gave this chart out also. And this is a, in my estimation, extremely valuable chart when you're studying the prophets. And if you'll look at when Habakkuk's timeline, not necessarily his lifeline, but the time in which he prophesied. You'll notice something really interesting right here, right? You should know by just looking at where he is positioned right here. This is the Babylonian, 70 years of Babylonian captivity here in the blue. This is Assyrian captivity. And we know that Israel was carried away captive. They never came back. Judah was left alone on the bottom half of this chart. And so the prophets who are prophesying down here Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Nahum, those prophets are prophesying exclusively to Judah because Israel doesn't exist anymore. They've been carried away captive and they're never coming back. And so throughout the Assyrian captivity, you have Nahum and Zephaniah who are going to be prophesying, and you can almost know what they're going to be prophesying about before you ever open and read it. They are very likely going to be prophesying that Assyria is going to fall and Babylonia is going to come on the scene. And then when you get here to Jeremiah, you can see that his early prophecies were in Assyrian time. The latter prophecies were in Babylonian time. And when you look at Habakkuk, he starts right there when the Babylonians come into power. And that's what he's going to be talking about. And so keep that in your mind as you read through Habakkuk. It's only three chapters. It doesn't take you but about 10 minutes at the most to read through it. And Habakkuk is an interesting prophet because, from several perspectives, but one is because he's not prophesying to the people. It is a dialogue between God and Habakkuk, the whole three chapters. And Habakkuk has a problem. And he verbalizes his problem in chapter 1, verse 1 through 4. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet received, and here's what he says. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore the law is paralyzed. Justice never prevails. The wicked hem into righteousness so that justice is perverted. Have you ever felt like, here's the problem. The problem is Habakkuk says, I dial 911 and nobody's answering. And I have kept on praying and praying and praying. Why won't you answer me? Why do you make me live in the midst of these people who are violent and these people who profane your name? How long must I call for help and you won't answer me? Have you ever felt that in your life? You were in a stressful situation in your life and you prayed about it and you prayed about it and you prayed about it and that prayer wasn't answered? And you feel like, well, you know, is God there? Does he care? Well, that's the situation that Habakkuk is in. He says, God, why don't you do something about this wickedness in Judah? There are many people who come to this point and they pray to God and they don't see an answer, and so they decide what? There's nobody up there. Nobody's listening. So there is no God. And he says, the law is paralyzed. We could take every one of these statements, and there really is some insights into this. The law is paralyzed. Whenever there are corrupt courts, law is of no benefit. The only time that there is benefit to law is when that law is administered fairly and justly. And it wasn't being during this time. And so law, even though God's law was there, it didn't provide the answer, did it, that he was looking for. And so he's laid out his concern before God. And now God's going to answer, beginning in verse 5. And what he says is, Habakkuk, I am doing something. You just don't recognize it. The Lord says, look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed. For I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe even if you were told. And you can look right here and see what it is that God's about to do in Habakkuk's time. He says, I am raising up the Babylonians. And when he says that, I wasn't there, but I can promise you, Habakkuk drew a sharp breath when he said that. Because God is about to lay claim to something that Habakkuk just cannot believe that God would do. What do you do whenever you have this kind of threat to your faith? Whenever there is something that God does, something that happens in this world, and you can't make it jihad, you can't make it mesh with your faith. And so he says, God says, look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed. I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. I'm raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They're a law to themselves. They promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture swooping down to devour. They all come bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They deride kings. They scoff at rulers. They laugh at all the fortified cities. They build earthen ramps and capture them. They sweep past like the wind and go on. Guilty men whose own strength is their God. Here's the interesting thing about God raising Babylon up. God knows everything there is to know about Babylon. He knows they're vicious. He knows they're killers. He knows that they're bitter. He knows that they're ruthless. He knows that they're cold-hearted. He knows that they kill women and children as a sport. He knows all those things about them, and yet he says, I'm raising them up. I got a question. Is it something unthinkable that ISIS could take over the United States of America? Is that something that's just beyond the scope of our ability to comprehend? Because they're so violent, right? They're so wicked because they don't serve our God. That couldn't happen, right? These people in Babylonia, they didn't recognize God. They were every bit as violent as ISIS is. When they captured a city, they beheaded children. They killed people just because. They didn't have to have a reason. And God said, I raised them up. Can you understand when you put it in those kind of terms about ISIS, can you understand why it would be such an incredibly hard thing to believe that that could possibly happen? God couldn't let that happen. We're a Christian nation, right? You think? What do you think Judah thought? And Jeremiah will say, you people walk by and you see the temple and you say, hey, everything's fine. Look at the temple. There's where God is. We're God's people. And how long have we taken such a confidence? I'm not a prophet. I'm not prophesying anything. I'm just saying let's put this thing in the perspective of that day and let's make an application and let's know something about God that we might not want to recognize. Because God used a nation every bit as wicked as any nation that's on the face of the earth today. And every bit as ruthless and cold-hearted as any nation that's on the face of the earth today. And he said, you think I'm silent? You've been praying to me. You want me to do something about all this injustice and violence among my people. Habakkuk, I'm doing something. Now, have you ever told on somebody as a kid and you wanted to get them in trouble, but they got in bigger trouble than you wanted them to get into? That's happened to me a time or two with my sister. I wanted her to get in trouble, but she got in bigger trouble than I meant for her to get into, okay? And I wanted to take it back. I have to stop and tell you this little story because it's one that a good friend of mine told me. He grew up with two older brothers, and they grew up literally as sharecroppers. in Oklahoma. And he told me lots of stories about his two older brothers. I mean, he was like about eight or ten years younger than the next oldest one. So he was the little brother that tagged along that nobody ever wanted. You know what I'm saying? And so his brothers were always slipping off to go smoke a cigarette somewhere, and he wanted to slip off with them, and they knew that he'd go back and tell their mom and daddy. And so they would literally throw rocks at him like a dog to chunk him back to the house, you know, make him go back home. Well, they were going to town one day on the horse. They only had one horse, and they were both on the horse. They were going to town, and so he was running along behind them. And he knew that he had to run along behind them a long ways because they'd loop back around if they saw him following. So that, but they did see him. And so they turned around, went back, and told him to go on back home. You know, whatever they were going to do in town, they didn't want him along. And so he acted like he was going home. He got out of sight, and he turned around, and he came back. Well, they knew what he was going to do, so they were waiting for him. And so they roped him like a steer, and they tied him up, and they threw the other end of the lariat over a limb, and they pulled him up and tied him in the tree with his arms tied to his side and left him there and went to town. And so he's up in the tree screaming and hollering for help, and, you know, he did for a long time. And finally, a neighbor down the road heard somebody hollering for help, and he came and looked and saw him hanging in the tree, and he knew exactly what had happened. He just, you know, laid on the ground, died laughing because he knew what had happened. So anyway, my friend, he let him down, and, of course, he hit the ground running to tell his daddy what they'd done to him. So when he got back, his daddy cut a willow limb and proceeded to give them a, we recently heard in the news, a whooping. I mean, a whooping. And I asked him when he told me that story, I said, well, you know, he said, I mean, he worked them over. And I said, well, did you feel sorry for him? He said, no, I didn't, you know. But a normal person would have felt sorry for him at that point, okay? And so this is where Habakkuk finds himself. He went to God, and he told on him. And God said, I'm taking care of that. And when he told him what he was doing, Habakkuk now had a bigger problem than he had before. And he stopped. In fact, I wrote out some things and see if this helps you any. What do you do when you have this sort of threat to your faith? Whenever there is something that's happening that you can't mesh with your theology, you can't understand God is all powerful and God's in control of the world and nations and so forth, and we see things happening that we just say, well, How could God be good, and how could God be all-powerful and allow these things to happen? So I'm going to suggest three things here from Habakkuk that I think Habakkuk did whenever he was confronted with this dilemma about God. Number one, stop and recall. Don't react out of fear. Don't react emotionally. Don't react out of anger. Stop and recall everything you know about God. Literally. Stop and think what you know about God. And this is why I say it is so incredibly important that you know God. Secondly, apply what you know about God to this situation. And when you've done your best to do that, you might come up with an answer. Or you might not. A lot of that will have to do with how much you know about God. Most people, when they apply what they know about God to this situation right here, they're no better off than they were when they started because they don't know God well enough to know that God punishes. Behold the goodness of God, but also what? Behold the severity of God. God can be incredibly severe. If you don't believe it, talk to those folks who drowned in the flood. Talk to those people who inhabited Canaan whenever he led his people. He sent a man to take the promised land. Talk to some of those inhabitants. Ask them if God can be severe. Talk to these people who were carried away into captivity. Ask them if God can be severe. And so you've got to know God, not just the popular God, not just the God that people claim today and talk about today. They've created their own God who has only some, perhaps some, of the characteristics of true God. And then thirdly, after you've applied what you know to the situation, regardless of what you come up with, regardless of the answer that you derive from making that application, ask yourself this: do I trust God? Do I trust Him? Because I'll tell you this, there'll be some times when you're not going to be able to come up with the right answer. You might come up with an answer, but it might not be the right answer. Because if all you know about God is His love and goodness and kindness, and actually that's not quite true, because even God's wrath is His love in agony. You can write that down. It's not original with me. R.C. Bell said that a long time ago in a little book on Romans. God's love, or God's wrath, is His love in agony. But most people can't see the severe side of God. And so everything in all of life comes down to two options. Can you trust God, or do you trust yourself? Everything comes down to that. It's all about faith. And so, have you noticed how often it is that whenever you look at a situation and you see something happening that you can't understand, that it seems like God's always doing things the wrong way, that He didn't consult me? And when he got His answer, whenever God told him, he complained about the situation, God said, "I've got it in control." He told him what He was doing. That's not the answer he was looking for. That answer came from somewhere he had never considered before. He's kind of like Job. You remember all the way through the book of Job, Job kept saying, God won't give me a hearing. God won't listen to me. If God would just put somebody between myself and Him and let me appeal my case, I know that I would prove myself righteous before God. And he maintained that all the way through the book. And finally, God said, "Okay, you that darken your words with or counsel with words, stand up. You're about to get your audience." And when God got through with him, the answer that he got was one that he had never, ever remotely conceived of before. God started talking about things that he didn't even know were a part of this problem. You see, God's ways are higher than our ways. As high as the heaven is above the earth. How high is that? Infinitely high. Right? As far as the east is from the west. How far is the east from the west? It just keeps going, doesn't it? And so God's answer to problems, we think that we've got God figured out and we've got God in a box and God's got to do this way. I've heard people make a statement like, if God doesn't punish America, then He's going to have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. No, God doesn't have to do anything that you tell Him He has to do. God is God, you're not. God's ways are higher than your ways and my ways. And there are things involved that we don't even know anything about. And we look at how God handles this problem and we just flip out. We say, God, how can you do that? And that's exactly what He did. Oh Lord, in verse 12, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, we will not die. Now, that's a little bit of a difficulty. This is the way I interpret what he just said. I think he stopped. When God told him what he was doing, I think he stopped and he started thinking about what he knew about God. And he said, God, I know that you're from everlasting. In other words, you're not confined by any single or group of events in history. You supersede history. You created history. You were here before history began, and you'll be here after the world's history is no more. You're from everlasting to everlasting. I know that about you. And so you're not small. You're not confined. You're not finite. You're infinite. And so I know that this situation is not bigger than you. And then he uses a word whenever he says, "My God, my Holy One." He uses the word that God introduced himself to his people back in Moses' day when he said, you remember whenever God was calling him and he said, "Well, who am I going to tell the people that you are?" And he revealed himself, "I am that I am." And that's the title that he uses, that God used on that occasion. And so he's going back and he's recalling what he knows about God. And he says, "You're the Holy One." What does that mean? It means that, "God, I know that you're righteous. I know that what you do is right." And so he's drawing on all the things that he knows about God. And he is applying it to this situation. He said, "And will not die. I know that you can work this out. And you've made promises to your people. And those promises are not yet all fulfilled. And so I know you're not going to wipe us out. I know that we're not all going to die. You have appointed them to execute judgment. You have ordained them to punish." And so, okay, I can get my mind around that kind of. That you would punish your people. Your people need punishing. That's why I've been crying out to you. Because even I recognize that you need to do something in this situation. And so, okay, I can see that you have chosen another nation. He had already chosen Assyria for Israel, the 10 northern tribes, right? So I can kind of understand that. But God, I've got a real problem here now. I mean, he wanted to step up to the plate to bat, but God threw a fastball that was so fast he couldn't even begin to swing at it. He threw something at him that he didn't know how to hit. "God, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Then why do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? How can you do that? I know some things about you. And I know you're not going to wipe us out. I know you're holy. I know you're righteous. And I know that you punish. But how can you use people like those Babylonians to punish us? They are godless. They don't even serve you. They operate by their own strength. They are merciless. They are horrible people. How could you use somebody like that? I know we're bad, but we're not as bad as they are. How could you do that?" And then he says, "You've made men like fish in the sea, like creatures that have no ruler." And then he starts talking about what these Babylonians do. The wicked foe pulls them all up with hooks. He catches them in his net. And he's talking about what the Babylonians do when they come through. He gathers them in his dragnet, and he rejoices, and he's glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net, he lives in luxury, and he enjoys his choicest food. What does his net represent? His own power, his own strength, his own doing. And so who is it that he worships? He worships himself. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? And then he says, "I know what I'll do. I'll just be real quiet and be real still and see what God does." And that's a wise thing to do. Sometimes when our reasoning runs out and we can't understand it and we've applied whatever we know to a situation and we just can't make sense out of that situation, then the best thing that we can possibly do, I will stand at my watch, station myself at the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. I've asked you, what am I supposed to say to people when they come to me and say, how can this be happening? And you've given me an answer that is really a hard answer. And so all I know to do is just be real quiet and see what you do. And folks, that's really what we get down to, isn't it? If you really believe that God is all-powerful, if you really believe that God is a God who lives up to His promises, and you look around you, and things just seem to, I mean, all the nations at war today, all the violence, all the people, the innocent children that are being killed, all the trafficking, that a big article yesterday about ISIS was capturing women and selling them at high prices to recruit some of these young men. They would sell them a woman. How horrible can people be to one another? You go back and read about World War II and what Hitler did to the Jews. How can one human treat other humans that way? Was God's hand in that anywhere? Well, I'm going to have to let God tell you. But He said that things don't happen without Him being involved in it in this world. Maybe I need to know more about God. Maybe that's one of the things that I need to conclude. And so the Lord answers him. He says, sit down, get your pen and your paper, and write down what I'm about to tell you so that you'll know how to answer. He says, for, and then he gives him a little warning in verse 3, for the revelation, I'm in chapter 2, verse 3, for the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end. It will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. And so what he says is, I'm about to tell you what's going to happen, but don't be shocked if it doesn't happen tomorrow. But be assured it's going to happen. And whatever happens between now and what I've said is going to happen is really immaterial. Because you can know one thing for sure. This is going to happen because I've said it's going to happen. Now, is there anything in our future that God has said is going to happen that we can bet our lives on? Yeah, there is something. You know what it is? He's coming back in judgment. And whatever happens between now and then, in a sense, is immaterial. Because we can base our lives on what He said is going to happen. Well, how are we going to be able to survive all these things that seem so unjust? Well, look at verse 4. He is puffed up. His desires are not upright. But the righteous will live by his faith. That's one of the great statements of the Bible right there. It's quoted 3 times in the New Testament. In Romans, in Galatians, and in Hebrews. And you can base your life on it. In fact, you better be basing your life on it. Because that's the only thing that's going to get you through difficulties. Because if you depend on circumstances and you being able to figure them out and your observations and your reasoning, if you depend on those things to provide you the answer, you're not going to stay faithful to God. There's only one thing that's going to keep you faithful to God. And that is, you trust Him enough to know that if He said it, it's going to happen. And if the Lord's coming back one day to claim His own, I know this much. I want to be one of His. And I don't want to allow the circumstances that I see around me, regardless of how unjust or unrighteous or un-whatever they are, I don't want those things to cause me to doubt my God. Because He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. I don't have all the answers of what's happening in life. People, I have questions just like you do. I have more of a sense of peace than lots of folks that I know because I trust God. And I know this. You know, the story that I heard as a child ended and they lived happily ever after. And we learned that that's a fairy tale and that didn't happen. Right? Except, it does happen. If you're a child of God, then that's a given. That's a fact. And they lived happily ever after if you stay faithful to God. The devil is incredibly powerful. And when I read the news and I read about what's happening to little children and innocent people around the world in so many different wars that are going on, it just sends a chill down my spine to think of the possibility that something like that could come to our shores. Don't think it couldn't. I mean, it was just a month ago that we heard that we had nothing to fear from Ebola. Right? I mean, a month ago. And they assured us, everywhere that you turn, it couldn't happen. Well, guess what? You can't depend on what people tell you. You can't depend on the guarantees that people in the world give you, but you can depend on what God tells you. He'll never, ever lie to you. He'll never deceive you. So that we can say, I won't be afraid of what man can do to me, because God is my helper. And if you're not basing your life on God, and if you're not living by faith, then you're wasting your life. In fact, it's worse than wasting your life. Because we have the opportunity to come to know God. And so I want to encourage you to take advantage of every opportunity. It's one reason we're reading our Bibles through. I tell you, you may not ever believe it, but I'm going to tell you over and over, you cannot come to know God in the New Testament like you can in the Old Testament. You can know some things about God. You can know some incredible things about God. You can know about how He loves you and how He sent His Savior, His Son, to become our Savior. But you get to know God by reading and studying and contemplating the whole Bible. And there are things about God that a lot of people don't know, and when they do hear about them, they refuse to accept them. We better come to know God. And that will give you a security in your life that you can't have any other way. If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, it's His invitation. There's no life worth living outside of Jesus Christ. And He gives you the opportunity to be His brother, His sister, to be a child of God tonight. And so if you have a need, won't you please come while we stand and sing?